Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be back here for this double celebration. And also, I must say, I feel really privileged to attend such a good conference. And in itself, it's also the third celebration, the unity of theoretical physics, as Piero Helberg was mentioning. And so I like it particularly. And I will take you to one corner of theoretical physics, which is disordered systems. And I will start by spin glasses. So these are very simple systems in which you have just spins like manganese impurities in copper, and they interact. And the interaction depends on the distance between the spins. And as a consequence, they are either ferromagnetic or antiferromagnetic interactions. And that creates a strange phenomenology and a strange order. What I like particularly is that they are totally useless. But in spite of that, there have been thousands, probably tens of thousands of papers. When I started on this topic, there were already 2,000 papers. I did not go through all of them. But by now, there might be tens of thousands. And in spite of the fact that nobody has found any possible application, and there is, as you know, there is a grand pressure and so on, but still it is like that. So the one question is why? And there is a broad range of answers. And I will tell you the two extremes in some sense. One extreme is just inside the field, that is the glass transition itself. It's a very interesting transition, with quotation marks actually. It's a freezing without a symmetry breaking. It's ubiquitous in the physical world, and you can find it, I mean, if you start to decrease rapidly the temperature, then a system will go in a glass phase. Any system will reach a glass phase. So it's something that you find anywhere. And at the other extreme, there is what Phil Anderson actually had named the cornucopia of spin glasses. That is, if you take a kind of historical perspective, for many decades, statistical physics, solid state physics, was dealing with ordered systems. I mean, systems which have a good symmetry and so on. Then it starts to add defects to that, study the defect. But in spin glasses, it's no longer a matter of defects. It's a completely dirty system, full of disorder. Because of that, each spin sees a completely different environment. It's different from all the other spins. If you are able to understand the collective behavior of all that, then it opens up a lot of possible studies of systems in which you will have many interacting atoms, where atoms can be very different systems. And what is important is that each atom sees a completely different environment from all the other ones. And that's also what makes the difficulty. You cannot make the simple mean field theory in which there is one representative atom in a kind of self-consistent theory. So atoms can be spins, can be a molecule in structural glasses, vortex, can be an electron, can be a neuron, can be a logical variable, an economic agent. And I will not try to give you to survey all of that for you. But I want to give you a little bit of the phenomenology, first of all. So I will go through an example. And glass phenomenology, it's basically dynamical effects. And here is an experiment which was done in Saclay. I've not written any reference because of lack of space. But that was an experiment done on Saclay on a susceptibility measurement of a spin glass. And so here is a magnetic susceptibility as function of time. And the system has been brought at time zero to its spin glass phase. It has been cooled to 12 Kelvin, which is in its spin glass phase. And the first thing that you see that there is a relaxation of this susceptibility. But here, if you notice the scale, it's on the scale of 400 minutes. So these systems are very, very slow relaxation. The thing which is striking, I have not shown the picture here, but if I had taken a system and I look at a system which is older, then it will relax more slowly. So the response of the system depends on its age. That's the aging phenomenon. That's something very striking. And another thing which is striking in this experiment is the following. After 400 minutes, the experimentalists got bored, and they decided to change a little bit the temperature. So they decreased the temperature by 2 Kelvin, bring the system to 10 Kelvin. Then there is a new relaxation. The system realizes that it wants to order in a different pattern than the one that he wanted to order at 12 Kelvin. You see it very well here. And then it starts to relax. And after 800 minutes, they decided to get back to 12 Kelvin. And the thing which happens here is that when it gets back to 12 Kelvin, it gets back exactly at the place where it was when they had decreased the temperature. That's shown here in the inset. So here is a case of a system which displays, by a small change of temperature, it displays a new dynamics plus a memory of the situation that it had before. And this can be done, and you can imagine that one can have a whole combinatorics of that with many nice experiments. And so now I will go to some more theoretical issues about the glass phase. So glass phase is a freezing of degrees of freedom. That is, then the positions, if these are particles, molecules, or the spins, orientations, they stop evolving at some point, or evolve only on a time scale which is of the order of the age of the system. That's the aging effect. And the main questions, some of the main question is it a purely dynamical effect? Is there an equilibrium phase transition behind that? Are there diverging length scale? And these are a lot of questions which have been addressed over the past 25 years. The situation is not as, it depends a little bit on the system. For instance, concerning the diverging length scale, there is a clear evidence for spin glasses that there is a diverging susceptibility, inferring that there is a diverging length scale, while people are trying to find one for structural glasses, and the situation is really not yet completely clear. So, as far as dynamical effects are concerned, there is this aging effect that I was mentioning. It's here in spin glasses, we have seen it. It's here in structural glasses. If I take your plastic ruler and I compress it and I look at the relaxation of the pressure will decay in time. And the time scale on which it decays depends directly, is proportional to the age of your plastic ruler. So I can know when it was built, for instance. And so it's something that is ubiquitous. There are also nice things, which is a modification of the fluctuation-dissipation relation, because these systems are no longer in equilibrium, so, you know, it's a very wild world. I mean, anything can happen. But still, we know from mean field studies, some very specific pattern of how the fluctuation-dissipation relation should be modified through the introduction of an effective temperature, and this is being measured now. And along with that, there was some other routes approaching the dynamical effects. I mean, there was also some more phenomenological routes, like TRAPS model, the fact that these systems, they are frustrated because there is not a single order. It's not a ferromagnetic system. There is not an obvious order in which it will freeze. So because of that, there are a lot of metastable states which act as traps for the systems in dynamics. And on the other hand, if I look at equilibrium glass phase, and here I have a question mark because nobody has been able to show that there is an equilibrium glass phase. I mean, it's not known whether it really exists or not, and that's a very interesting question. It's something that is strange. It has the same symmetry as the liquid or the paramagnetic state. So one natural question is, what is an equilibrium order parameter for these systems? Back 30 years ago, something like that, Edwards and Anderson proposed an order parameter which was just the time persistence of the structure. So look at the particles, for instance, take a structural glass. The particles tend to freeze in some kind of structure. It does not have Bragg peaks. You cannot identify it so simply. But still, it is a frozen structure. And if you compare it at time zero and time t, if it is the same, then you have time persistence of the structure, and that's the order parameter. How do you do that in an equilibrium framework? And the answer is that you should do that using a trick which has been called replicas. And I will show you here how replicas work in two words. Yeah, so here is my system. These are the blue particles. And they interact with the potential, which is your favorite one, Lennard-Jones potential, for instance. And I bring them to low temperature. And what I have done is I have done a copy of this system, a second copy, with the red particles. So the two red particles also interact with the Lennard-Jones potential. Now I turned on a small attraction between the red and blue particles. This is an attraction which is short range of the order of the interparticle distance and of strength epsilon. Now what happened? If epsilon is very big, then of course they will build some dimers, and you will have molecules containing each one red and one blue particle. But now the thing that you do is that you send you take the thermodynamic limit of your system, and then after that you send this coupling epsilon between the red and the blue to zero. And so the particles with different colors no longer interact. So you would say they have no reason to stick together. And that depends a lot on what is the structure of your system. If the system is a liquid, the red and blue particle will completely separate, and you will see that there are no correlations between them in this limit. On the other hand, if the system is a solid, then, for instance, this blue particle it is no longer attracted by the red, but it is in a cage. It is repelled by all these other blue particles around. The red one, it is also in a cage, and because I have created my system initially by putting some attraction, these cages, they are correlated self-consistently. And if this self-consistency extends to infinity, then it means that I will have correlations between the red and the blue, even in this epsilon going to zero limit. So this is the natural order parameter for my system. It turns out that if now I have not only one structure in which my system can freeze, but I have many of them, an exponential term, exponential n times sigma. Sigma is called the complexity. There is a nice way to compute this complexity, which is just to generalize this problem to m colors. And so these are called, you can call them replicas if you want. You compute this partition function, and it turns out that it's just the Legendre transform of the complexity. So this is where replicas come from. They're something with, you need them to define just an order parameter. And so, and if ever you thought that replicas were used to compute a logarithm and average a logarithm of a disorder, that's wrong. I mean, that's the right interpretation. Okay, we have also, in this field, we also have a landscape. People even talk sometimes of a landscape paradigm, but I don't like the expression. And the reason is that in these systems which have frustration, so there is not a single natural order, frustration just means that you have antagonist local constraints. You cannot satisfy all the constraints simultaneously. As a consequence, you have many metastable states not related by a symmetry, and each atom or spin has a different local field environment susceptibility. So the natural question that you will ask now is, find and count the metastable states, identify the phase diagram, understand their relevance for the dynamics that's specific for the physical problems, and understand the length scale. But then there are also interesting questions concerning the landscape engineering, because you have this system which has a lot of metastable states, and if by tuning some parameters you are able to build, to really shape the deep metastable states, then you can engineer the landscape and you can use it for memory neural networks, you can use it for error correcting codes, and also it has to do with the modeling of interacting economical agents. So I will not try to survey all of that, but I will give you one example, which is in the field of optimization. So optimization is an old problem. I mean, you can date it back to the old problem of the seven bridges of Königsberg. This is a map of Königsberg, and you want to go through all bridges and get back home and cross each bridge only once. And this was solved by Euler in 1736. He drew this small graph, and he realized that what you have to do on this graph is go once through every edge of the graph. And then he showed that this is possible if and only if each vertex of this graph has even degree, which means that in this case it's impossible. So that's typical of a problem which is called polynomial. I have just given you, with this small theorem of Euler, a polynomial algorithm. I mean, an algorithm, the computation times just grows linearly in the number of vertices. Another problem, famous, is a game that was invented by Hamilton, which is the Icosian game. And the game is to look at this object, and one wonders whether there is a possibility to go through each vertex of this object only once, exactly once. That's called now a Hamiltonian circuit. And so the question of whether there is a Hamiltonian circuit on this object, the answer is yes, it's drawn here. And that's a much more complicated problem. There is no simple polynomial algorithm. It's a problem which is called NP-complete, which, I will not go in the details of the definition, but basically it means that so far we don't know of any polynomial algorithm for that, and people would be very surprised if there would be a polynomial algorithm which would solve any instance in the worst case of the Hamiltonian circuit. So the father of the NP-complete problems, which is the problem of satisfiability. And it's best described by this small text from Brian Hayes, which is something that is of practical importance. You are chief of protocol for the embassy bar. The crown prince instructs you either to invite Peru or to exclude Qatar. The queen asks you to invite either Qatar or Romania or both. The king, in a spiteful mood, wants to snub either Romania or Peru or both. Is there a guest list that will satisfy the whims of the entire royal family? So that's an interesting problem. It's very practical. Of course, it's not relevant for all the celebrations that take place here because everybody agrees on whom to invite. But sorry, too much. But let's see how one can model this problem. So the configurations of this problem are assignments of Boolean variable. P takes the value 0 if Peru is not invited, takes the value 1 if Peru is invited. Then I have constraints. And in this case, constraints have the form of clauses. For instance, you invite Peru or exclude Qatar. You can write it as P or not Q. So you have a bunch of constraints like that. And the question, is there a choice of P, Q, R such that all constraints are satisfied? In general, of course, you will be interested in this problem in the limit in which you have a large number of variables, many constraints. And it's an example of a constraint satisfaction problem. There are many such constraint satisfaction problems. And if you think about it, they pop up really in various branches of science, and they are very interesting. And it was the first problem to be shown to be NP-complete by Cook in 71. So it's a very, very crucial problem in all this theory of complexity. Is it a difficult problem? When people went into experiment, numerical experiment for that, taking a random problem in which you have, for instance, exactly three variables per constraint. And then there is a control parameter, which is the number of constraints per variable. And here is plotted the probability that you will find a solution which satisfies all constraints. And it does what it should do. I mean, if there are very few constraints, their probability is equal to 1. If there are very many constraints, it goes to 0. But now there is a size effect. Here is a system with 100 variables. Here is a system with 200 variables. And people did a very nice finite size scaling of all that and so on and found out that there is a threshold and a phase transition. And the computer scientists call it a phase transition, as we all do in this kind of situation. And it has been even shown rigorously that there will be a step function asymptotically at large n. So that's interesting, but what is even more interesting is that if you look at computer time, the time it takes to really solve this problem with the best available program, then computer time, the problem is easy when there are very few constraints. When there are many constraints, it's also easy because you soon identify that there is a contradiction somewhere. And the real difficulty is in the region of the phase transition. And that's a very interesting problem from this point of view. That is, it interests us physicists because of the phase transition, and that's exactly the place which is of interest also to computer scientists. So there has been some statistical physics study of the random three-sat problem, and there have been two main kind of results, just to show you an example of how really this statistical physics can bring some results in other fields. The first is a result on the phase diagram, and the phase diagram is slightly more complicated than what one could expect from the previous numerical experiment. Again, here is a control parameter, the number of constraints per variable. This is a threshold, which has been determined with arbitrary precision, so solution of some kind of integral equations. And here is the unsat phase. Here is the sat phase. But the surprise is that the sat phase has, so it's a phase in which one can, with probability 1, there is a solution in this problem. But actually, it has two phases. One is a very simple one in which there is one big cluster of solution, and you can go from one solution to the other one by just changing one variable at each time. Here is an intermediate phase, and this intermediate phase is called the hard sat phase because the space of solution has separated into clusters which are very far away in phase space. If you are here, you cannot jump to here unless you flip simultaneously a fraction of all variables. Simultaneously to that, there are a lot of metastable states which are trapping any kind of algorithm, and so that's a very difficult phase. And the second result was a new algorithm based on the same idea that were used to derive a phase diagram. And this algorithm is able to solve up to 10 to the 7 problem with 10 to the 7 variables very close to the threshold. So just in 1 minute, I give you the idea of how this is done. First of all, one has a graphical representation of the problem. Here is a satisfaction problem in which I have a certain number of clauses. So each clause is denoted by a square. Each variable is a circle. And for instance, there is a clause X1 bar, X or X2 bar, or X4 bar, which is this clause here. So you see that any satisfiability problem. I can write it as a diagram like that. And then the solution that was worked out is interpreted as messages which are passed on this factor graph. And these messages, they can have different nature. If you study a simple problem like the liquid phase, which is the easy sat phase, then the messages are just something that we would call the better approximation. It's just some contribution, local magnetic field that are passed on this graph. And that's enough to solve the easy problem. I'm nearly done. But when you go into the glass phase, then you are in the hard sat phase. This is really a glass phase. And then you have to go to something which is a cavity method. That's a method that we had been developing for spin glasses, and which turns out to show full power on these kind of systems, in which the messages are really probabilities of the previous messages. So they are rather complicated objects, but still it is from far the best algorithm that is known on this kind of problem. So this is a kind of approach. It was just to give an example, but there are a lot of contacts at this moment between people in statistical physics and in various branches of computer science and information theory, error correcting codes, and so on. And I think it will be a very lively field in the next 20 years. Thank you.